find the defendants incredibly guilty.
Find this ultimate chicken sandwich on brioche bun to be guilty of being delicious.
Right.
What section of the Constitution has been breached?
There is no one section. It's just the vibe of the thing.
Objection, Your Honor.
What?
He's leading the witness.
Say.
You break, we're both lawyers.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 252. Yeah, nice number there. A little numerologic. It's a good one.
Palindromic number.
Yeah. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am fantastic. Now I'm super fantastic that we have a great numerology bit back at the beginning again. I've missed those. How are you?
Doing well. I am so excited about this episode. It is a fun Tuesday episode. We've got a really good listener question about Citizens United that I can't wait to hear your take on. Of course, we've got a little bit of bad news with Barr going to be confirmed shortly, but we get to talk about some fun stuff in the Proud Boys lawsuit. I don't think I would ever be a member of something. Well, I would never be a member of virtually anything because I'm not a member of guy, but a group called the Proud Boys would be somewhere toward the bottom. I don't even know what they stand for, even if they were not racist, which they are. I don't just Proud Boys. Are you? What is? No. But anyway, we're going to talk about that lawsuit.
Yes, we are.
And we get to be introduced to another person who's blocked Andrew on Twitter. I think I'm pretty sure you were blocked by some number of serial people, right?
So. Yeah. So, yeah. Apparently, I am both a tool of the far left and of the far right. So, yeah. No, that's gonna be a fun conversation.
All right. Well, let's get started. So much to talk about. Here we go.
Political. Political.
Let's get into political. So, tell us what's happening with Bill Barr. Give us an update there.
Yeah. So end of last week on Thursday, as we were recording this, the Senate Judiciary Committee on partisan lines approved Bill Barr to be Attorney General. Exactly as I expected, that vote was 12-10, which means that he will go to the full Senate for confirmation, could be as early as when this episode drops. And as I've said numerous times, I think that the final vote on the Senate floor will be to confirm Bill Barr. He will get at least 53 votes. He will get every Republican vote and may even pick off a Joe Manchin. And I mean, I don't see any reason. If you're Chuck Schumer, you would release any of your Democratic senators to vote for Barr if they feel like they have to do that. There is not going to be any momentum to stop it. And we've covered Barr rather extensively. And, I think that the fact that this highlights the importance of protecting the independence of Mueller's investigation. I think that those who do not wield power in the Senate did everything they could to reach the best possible outcome they could. So that's where we are.
Yeah, on the list of stuff, like injustice and stuff to oppose, like Barr is not that, I feel like if we rolled the dice again, we might get a worse outcome than Barr. I'm like, what do you think?
I completely agree with that. I know that that puts me at odds with some liberal groups, some of which are friends of the show and have appeared on the show, but I do agree
and,
with that.
And don't get me wrong. I still think Democrats should still just vote no because out of principle, but like, I'm not, you know, it's going to pass. He'll be confirmed and I'm not all that worried about it. And if anything, with Barr, I think there's at least an off chance, you know, a slight cause for optimism in that it just doesn't seem like he has much to gain by being a Trump crony and everything to lose in his legacy. Maybe that's wrong, but it's at least a possibility. And I don't think we're getting much better than this. So it's kind of one of those there are other battles. Maybe. I don't know. That's how I feel.
I agree with that.
All right. Well, it's agreed. We will vote opening arguments. We will. We still vote no, but we recognize that we're in the minority and it's he's going to be confirmed. So that's our official. We have a vote in the committee, right? Or
yeah, we don't. Yeah, we get we're an at large. So,
yeah,
sadly, it only makes it 12 to 11 with our vote.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
All right, let's get to what I think is a fantastic listener question. I always let, you know, we have the smartest listeners. Let's face it. Except for like, you know, all the Joe Rogan listeners who know the truth about the Illuminati and the moon landing being fake. But apart from those listeners, we have the smartest listeners. Ilya Hakimi asks, there are many groups fighting against corruption and the influence of money in politics. Because of Citizens United, some groups have called for an Article 5 convention to say that money is not speech. I believe they have already lobbied 5 states to make such a call. However, other groups, such as Common Cause, are against an Article 5 convention and prefer to get Congress to propose this amendment or get the Supreme Court to revisit Citizens United. My questions are, 1, what would be the ramifications of such an amendment on political speech? 2, what is the process for calling an Article 5 convention? And 3, can a limited Article 5 convention be called solely on one topic? So sounds like time to learn about Article 5 conventions.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So, Ilya, this is a fantastic question. I want to say 2 things preliminarily. Number 1, your description of the facts is entirely correct. So that is, you've gotten that 100% right. Number 2, the broader topic of what would overturning Citizens United do for political speech is on the whiteboard, and we will do a deep dive episode on Citizens United itself, because there would just be no way to do Article 5 and also what would that's just not going to happen in this episode. I am really, really looking forward to talking about Article 5 convention. So what the hell is an Article 5 convention? It actually comes from Article 5 of the Constitution, which says, the Congress, whenever 2/3 of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to the Constitution. Okay, that seems totally straightforward. Yeah. Or on the application of the legislatures of 2/3 of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments, which in either case, shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution when ratified by the legislatures of 3/4 of the several states or by conventions in 3/4 thereof as one or the other mode of ratification may be proposed by the Congress. So let's unpack that. The first part of the first sentence is how every constitutional amendment has been proposed to date. That is, the Congress, by 2/3 vote, has proposed a constitutional amendment. Mm. Then it goes out to the states.
So they've never done it the states way. None of them.
They've never done
none of the I don't know 50 or 60 amendment. None of the 47 amendment. Dang it, Brian, edit me to make me look smart. No, none of all of our amendments, huh? Not a single one.
Correct.
Andrew's rethinking all his choices of having me as a co-host. How do I get stuck with this guy? I'm kidding. I know there's like 20. Okay,
27. I was waiting for you to get it. I was like trying to filibuster while you could Google it. You know, but there we go. All of the existing constitutional amendments have been proposed in that first way. Right. So what is an Article 5 convention is that second way, right? Which is two-thirds of state legislatures apply and say, let's have a convention, and the convention will propose amendments to the Constitution, and then those amendments become effective when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the states, or by conventions in three-fourths thereof, as one of the other mode of ratification may be proposed by the Congress. Okay, so let's kind of unpack that a little bit. The only constitutional convention we have ever had in our nation's history was the Philadelphia Convention that produced this Constitution. That was convened, as many AP U.S. history students will know, not to create a new constitution, but to propose amendments to the Articles of Confederation. And what happened was delegates got there under a variety of different reasons, thinking that they were going to propose brand new amendments to the Constitution, to the old Articles of Confederation. And then when they got there, the delegates were like, no, wait, you know what? We're going to jettison this entire Articles of Confederation thing, and we're going to come up with an entirely new government. And that is, in fact, how we wound up with our existing constitution.
I've seen 1776, the musical. You don't need to.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, then, yeah. I won't go through 1787 then. You need to know the primary driver pushing for constitutional conventions right now is the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, A-L-E-C. You may have heard of ALEC if you are a regular consumer of left-leaning deep dive journalism, right? I think Rachel Maddow has talked about it. I think there's been a piece in The Nation on it. ALEC is funded by the Koch brothers. And what they do is they propose model legislation across the country. And so everything is standardized. So when you see, for example, these bills that come before state legislatures of we should, you know, prominently display the national motto in public schools, that's ALEC, right? Everything you see that is horrible at the state level is probably their fault. And ALEC has a model legislation, the key sentence of which reads, the legislature of the state of blank hereby applies to Congress under the provisions of Article 5 of the Constitution of the United States for the calling of a convention of the states limited to proposing an amendment to the Constitution of the United States requiring that in the absence of a national emergency, the total of all federal outlays in any fiscal year may not exceed the total of all estimated federal revenues for that fiscal year. Right. So a constitutional convention to propose an amendment to require that the budget be balanced, which would be stupid, but, yep, you know, whatever.
Which is weird. You'd think these conservatives might have some business acumen or education. You wouldn't want to run a business that way. So why? It's interesting.
Yeah, you wouldn't think so, but
you want to leverage your credit a little bit and grow and do that kind of thing.
Right. But the whole point of balanced budget amendments is to have mandatory cuts on government social programs, right?
Yeah.
That's why you do it.
I know. I was just pointing out the hypocrisy.
No. I know.
It doesn't even make business sense.
Our listeners might not have known. That's all.
Gotcha.
That's all I'm saying. I knew you know. I mean, you don't know how many amendments to the Constitution there are. But
it's not important, okay? There's only like a few of them that even matter.
It is not important. That is correct. That is absolutely correct. It is not important. So you might think then, okay, is it, Can an Article 5 constitution be convened on solely one topic? And the answer is, as far as I can tell, no, right? So
yeah, it doesn't really get that specific, it seems like, in Article 5.
No, it absolutely does not. And we have zero precedents to go on because
declare one and then you know, declare independence from another country again. Like who knows what might happen? Could be anything. Anything goes.
And that's part of the issue. Now, we have some guidance because many, many states have called constitutional conventions over the years. The issue that marks a major distinction, however, is that a state constitutional convention can rewrite the state Constitution and, you know, could do all sorts of crazy things. But ultimately, as we've learned, even though states are sovereign, due to the doctrine of incorporation, the Bill of Rights and the protections of the 14th Amendment and the rest of the Constitution apply, with few exceptions, to the states as well. And so if you had a state constitutional convention any particular state that said, you know what, we're just going to get rid of the equal protection clause in our state constitution, that would remove that as a state cause of action and a state right. But you would still have the benefits of the Fifth and 14th Amendment available to you as a citizen of that state. Let's right. just say Maryland, right? I'm not going to pick on a state right now. Let's say that it's Maryland, because it wouldn't be. My state is lovely and would never want to repeal the Equal Protection Clause. But if they did, I, as a Maryland citizen, would still be able to access the federal Equal Protection Clause through the doctrine of incorporation. So, in other words, state constitutional conventions could go off the rails, but they're always going to be guided by at least the minimums of the federal constitution. A federal constitutional convention starts with this problem, which is the Constitution provides absolutely no mechanism to check against what the Article 5 convention itself does, right? So in other words, the Article 5 does not say that if the convention proposes something that is beyond the scope to which it has been delegated, that could go to the Supreme Court for a minute, right? Like, it doesn't say anything, right? It provides no inherent authority above that of a constitutional convention. And the text says that whatever the constitutional convention does is then subject to the authority of the Constitution, right? So the way in which I read that is, you sign on, ALEC calls a constitutional convention for balancing the budget. The first thing you put on there is abolish the First Amendment, right? You couldn't go to the Supreme Court and say they have no authority to do this. The Supreme Court, I think, would say, no, this is a non-justiciable political question, right? Like, we were not given authority in Article 3 over constitutional conventions in Article 5.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of, right? Point number one is that there wouldn't be clear remedy even to the Supreme Court. There might be nothing that is higher than a constitutional convention. Well, and in fact, that's what happened in history. Yeah.
Yeah. That it has to be that way, I think.
It gets worse. Well, and again,
what do you mean worse? I feel like that's how it has to be. You can't, if the purpose of the Supreme Court is to see, you know, measure if things are constitutional, you know, if you're going to edit the Constitution, you can't ask the Constitution if it's okay to edit the Constitution. You know, it doesn't make sense.
Here's why I think it gets worse, though, because if you just read, because the first part, right, there are no limits in Article 5. Okay, well, we could have done the show in 5 minutes, been out of here, and, you know, you and I could have taken in a movie. That it's worse than that, because I think the language that purports to limit a convention in Article 5 is also potentially not enforceable. So let's go back to it, right? It says, okay, we summon a constitutional convention by the legislatures of 2/3 of the states. They propose amendments which shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of the Constitution when ratified by the legislatures of 3/4 of the several states. Okay, so you would say, okay, well, look, like, at least you have that check, right? 2/3 of the states propose a constitutional convention, but you got to ratify from 3/4 of the states when they're done, right? So, you know, that at least you got, as long as you have 13 states, you can stop, you know, this yeah. convention from totally going off the rails. However, again, I look back to sample size of one. But what happened at the 1787 convention was the Articles of Confederation required that proposed amendments be submitted to Congress and then ratified by all 13 states. Rhode Island opposed the changes that were being proposed at the 1787 Philadelphia Convention that gave us the Constitution. They did not send any delegates to that Philadelphia Convention, thinking that, okay, well, look, like, an amendment's got to come out and it's got to be passed by all 13 states. And we're just going to vote down whatever they do, so we're not even going to go, right? But the what the other states did was they created a new ratification process at the Constitutional Convention itself that said the Constitution would be effective if ratified by 9 states, and didn't have to be submitted to Congress at all. Completely changed the process. Rhode Island opposed the Constitution. They resisted ratifying it for several years. Ultimately, it came down. We've talked a little bit about the Rhode Island state constitution in prior episode. But they had the rules changed out from under them that were identical in terms of restrictions as Article 5. So in other words, I fear the second thing that a constitutional convention could do is propose as part of the amendments that the amendments become effective if ratified by a majority of the states or by 2/3 of the states or by the following enumerated states that happen to have majority Republican legislatures, right? Like there's nothing that I think we could do in light of past precedent other than take to the streets, right? And
that
refuse
never
to
happens,
acknowledge.
So.
Yeah, right. And finally, so if those two things aren't bad enough, the other problem with convening a constitutional convention, right? So it requires 2/3 of the states as approved by the Congress. And again, I would say I don't know that I trust Mitch McConnell not to aggregate together votes for the ALEC convention on the balanced budget with votes for far left groups. Constitutional conventions to overturn Citizens United. I wouldn't put that past Mitch McConnell. How about that? Once the convention is convened, they could change the process for representation for delegates to the convention itself, right? So you could you could go with a super Senate approach, right? You could say each state is going to get one vote. And now all we need are, you know, all of the rural unpopulated states. Oh, California, you sent a delegate. That's awesome. You get one vote. Congratulations. You just got outvoted by Utah, Wyoming, and Idaho. And so I don't see any mechanism to secure against any of those three things, right? Scope and challenges thereto, ultimate ratification of whatever they propose and representation at the convention. So I find this unbelievably dangerous. We get this question from time to time, yeah. And I wanted to unpack it. Look, if this is a strategy that the Koch brothers are pursuing, it probably is not a good strategy for us to be pursuing on the left as well, right? Like, I'm gonna just use that as a good rule of thumb. And because you might find yourself there. And I have no confidence that a constitutional convention would re-ratify anything like the 14th Amendment. We
so
see
I,
that right
I,
now.
I think what you're saying is this is a Pantera's box we do not want to open. Little mystery men for you. Yeah, so this is not a good idea.
This
Let's
is
not
a good idea.
This. I vote no.
Yeah, good idea.
So it makes sense that all the 30 or 40 amendments have been done not this way.
They've
been done. Let's stick to that other way if we want to try to get an amendment done.
That is why they have been done in that other way. Correct.
So then I guess I would ask, and I'm sure the questioner is probably wondering this as well, like what does that leave us? If given the state of how everything is now, how do you, candidate Andrew Torres, how would you propose we ever fix something like Citizens United? Is it just a question of wait 100 years until we get a new court because we ruined that in 2016 and /2014 when we, you know, lost the Senate or didn't win the Senate back? Or do we try for an amendment? What do you think is the best way?
So I think, right, both of those are exceedingly unlikely outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Waiting for the court to reverse itself or a constitutional amendment. Probably you would be better off with waiting for the court to reverse itself. And look, it's not hard to envision how that comes about, right? Like it it's hard to sort of see the path from here, but eventually, right, like the excesses of a court that is totally out of step with the majority of the American public, right? Like we've seen that historically in the past. Like we've talked about Roosevelt's court packing plan and the fact that it didn't have to be implemented because the Supreme Court was at the time in the earliest half of the 20th century was essentially laissez-faire, hardcore free market economists, and the country was essentially socialist.
The relationship between an employer and a 9-year-old child is a sacred contract that nobody should be that kind of thing.
Yes, right. Restraining work when New York passed a law. I mean, this is the Lochner case, right? When New York passed a law saying you can't require bakers to work more than 12 hours a day, the Supreme Court said that is interfering in the inherent right of contract.
We are insulted that you would even try to do that.
Right. So, and that was so out of step with a country that had just pretty much unanimously elected FDR to propose precisely the kind of programs that were being struck down by the Supreme Court. Eventually those two things will come to a head. I can't promise that it will be in 2020. I don't think that it will be. But if you believe in institutions of government, and you can be forgiven if you are skeptical of those, but I do, right? I wouldn't do this show. I wouldn't be a lawyer if I thought that this was all meaningless nonsense. And at some point, you know, push will come to shove and it will reach the threshold of, you know what, like the decisions of the 2010s, recognizing and institutionalizing and enshrining in the Constitution corporate rights that have never existed in our nation's history, that we made a mistake on that. And I think that will come, but hard to say when, and hard to say that there's a clear path there. No, that's not the answer you want, but that's the answer I have.
Well, I'm glad that I know what to say now whenever people talk about, we can have a constitutional convention or we'll have Article 5 convention. Like, yeah, okay.
You could, but you probably won't like what we'll get when we're done. So,
all right. Well, thanks for the deep dive. Hey, thanks for the question. It's
awesome
amazing.
Question.
We get great listener questions. Keep them coming. Hey, listeners, you know, let me tell you, I used to not care at all about how I looked or what clothes I wore. And as a result, there are a lot of pictures that are incredibly embarrassing now to look at. So I'm going to say, don't be like me. And here's a tip. No guy looks good in a long, bulky dress shirt when it's untucked or in a shirt that doesn't fit. And that's why I highly recommend Untuck It, because if you hop on their website, untuckit.com, or you can go to one of their 50 stores across the U.S. and Canada, you can get something that fits right and looks nice. And they solve that dilemma of either looking too casual and sloppy with an untucked shirt or too formal if you're trying to wear a button-up shirt in a casual situation that you'd have to tuck in, then you look really formal. They've solved that nicely, but they also have more. You know, I grabbed a performance sweatshirt from their website, and I love it because it's this perfect balance for me when I wear it when I'm going to go on a walk, maybe a vigorous walk, maybe a little bit of a jog, because it keeps you warm, but it's not bulky. It's nice and light. It's athletic. I love it. All I can say is for me, once I put the tiniest amount of effort into buying clothes that fit and look nice from Untuck It, it helps with all kinds of things. It makes you feel better, makes you feel more confident. And you're not going to be worried when you see a picture a few years later that, oh my gosh, what was I doing? And you're going to find whatever you need there. They've got more than 50 fit combinations to make sure you get that shirt that looks great on if you're tall, if you're short, slim, if you're athletic, any age. So go to untuckit.com or visit one of their stores and check it out. They even offer free shipping and returns on all orders in the U.S. And you can use promo code OA for 20% off your first purchase. So if you want the perfect fitting shirt, regardless of your shape and size, try the original untucked shirt. And remember, use promo code OA for 20% off your first purchase.
Okay, go ahead. I'm a proud Western chauvinist.
I'm a proud Western chauvinist.
And I refuse to apologize.
And I refuse to apologize.
For creating the modern world.
For creating the modern world. Okay, you will now name five breakfast cereals. One, two, three.
Captain Crunch, Fruit Loops, Mini Wheats, Raisin Bran.
Okay, I'm done. Was that five? I was concentrating on my punches too much.
All right, Twitter troll Andrew Torres here on the pod, blocked in every state in our fine union. No, what? Let's talk about Gavin McInnes and this Proud Boys lawsuit. I want to sue them for having a stupid name, but I'm guessing that's not what it is. why don't you tell us what happened here?
So I am going to read the first two paragraphs from Wikipedia. I am going to do that because I would be delighted if Ron Coleman, attorney for Gavin McInnes, decides to sue us for defamation. This is a publicly available, multiply vetted source, and I am reading what Wikipedia says about the Proud Boys. This will be linked in the show notes. Quote, "The Proud Boys is a far-right, neo-fascist organization that admits only men as members and promotes political violence. The group takes its name from the song Proud of Your Boy, written for the Disney film Aladdin. The group was started in 2016 by Vice Media co-founder and former commentator Gavin McInnes."
Can that be possibly be right? First on Proud of Your Boy in Aladdin, was that one of the tracks that didn't make it or something? What the heck is that?
Yeah. Proud. So this is, again, now I'm doing the mouse over.
I'm legitimately wondering if someone snuck this in as like a prank.
No, you know, like when you mouse over, Proud of Your Boy is a song written by Howard Ashman and composed by Alan Menken that was cut from the original 1992 Disney animated film Aladdin, only to be brought back for the film's stage musical adaptation in 2011.
Oh, okay.
I don't know the song. I have never seen the stage musical, and it's been a long time since I've seen the original animated movie. So never heard of the song. And that's what Wikipedia says about the song.
That can't be real. That cannot be where they got the name. Okay, whatever. I'm skeptical, but go on. Sorry.
Be skeptical, but this is, I think that skepticism will serve you well as we are defending ourselves from the inevitable nonsense lawsuit. That was sentence two. Sentence three. The group was started in 2016 by Vice Media co-founder and former commentator Gavin McInnes. Proud Boys emerged as part of the alt-right, but in early 2017, McInnes began distancing himself from the alt-right, saying that the alt-right's focus is race, while his focus is what he defines as, quote, Western values. This rebranding effort intensified after the Unite the Right rally. The group sees men, this is now paragraph two, especially white men and Western culture as under siege. Their views have elements of white genocide conspiracy theory. While the group claims that it does not support white supremacist views, I will resist adding a comment here. I'm just going to read from the Wikipedia article. Its members often participate in racist rallies, events, and organization. The organization glorifies violence and members engage in violence at events it attends. The Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC, has called it an alt-right fight club. Okay, so those are the facts of who the Proud Boys are. That last sentence about the Southern Poverty Law Center calling it an alt-right fight club, which, by the way, like that's really good wordsmithing there, I have to tell you. The fact that the SPLC has labeled the Proud Boys as a hate group has led Gavin McInnes to file a lawsuit against the SPLC. This is filed in federal court in the United States District Court for the Middle District of Alabama, which is a little bit of forum shopping to try and find the place where in paragraph 9 of your complaint, you can quote at length from Attorney General Jeff Sessions orating before the Alliance Defending Freedom at the August 2018 Summit on Religious Liberty Conference. Let's leave that alone for
Say this is a place where a lot of people have yearbook photos that they don't want coming out right about now.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Probably. I have told you that the first thing we do in reading a complaint is turn to the back page. You actually don't have to, based on how they've filed this particular complaint, where they've included counsel on the front page. It's not my practice in federal court, but it's it's Ron Coleman's practice in federal court. Gavin McInnes is represented by one of the nation's most preeminent First Amendment attorneys, a guy named Ron Coleman. If you recognize that name, and not just because I was complaining because he's blocked me on Twitter, it will be because he was the lead attorney for our friends, the Slants, in their First Amendment case. This is not his firm. Mandelbaum Salzburg in New York is a top-notch boutique firm. Ron has personally litigated at least dozens of high-profile First Amendment cases. He is eminently qualified. He knows the law. And it's why I was shocked to see his name attached to this lawsuit, because this lawsuit is total nonsense. I am not going to talk about the three of the four claims in this lawsuit, other than briefly, because again, you remember we read our complaints backwards. We go back, we look at the signature page. We say, is this being brought by, you know, a divorce lawyer moonlighting as someone for the ADF? Nope. It's being brought by a lawyer with significantly better credentials than me. Then we scroll back and go, what are the four counts here? Count one, I want you to put a pin in. That's what we're going to talk about. Tortious interference with economic advantage. Count two, defamation. This is 9 or 10 pages long. It's kind of a weird way of pleading defamation, but we all know what defamation is. Count three is false light invasion of privacy. And count four is aiding and abetting employment discrimination pursuant to New York labor law, section 201D. I'm not going to analyze the New York labor law section 201D because not a New York labor lawyer. He has described this law as saying, quote, no employer may discriminate against an employee or prospective employee because of his legal recreational activities outside of work hours, off the employer's premises, and without use of the employer's equipment or other property. That strikes me as crazy if that's the New York law. But hey, I can't control what people in New York pass as their laws. So I'm going to assume that he's correct on that as a matter of law. I don't know whether he is. I suspect that he may not be. But this is not a New York labor law podcast, so we won't be chatting about that. It is important to note, however, that the only way this lawsuit is being brought in Alabama, the only way in which New York labor law section 201D would apply is if you believe, as Gavin McInnes represented through your counsel, Ron Coleman, that New York state law applies to this complaint. That is going to be important. So remember that one when we go back.
I'm confused how that would work out, but we'll see. Okay.
So, the reason is because Gavin McInnes allegedly suffered his injuries in New York City, right? That's where he had a job, and he alleges that he was fired in New York and that he can't get a job in New York, right? So he worked for Blaze TV and CRTV in New York. And so when you have, right, the Southern Poverty Law Center, right, the statement is made out over the internet, you're trying to figure out what state's laws apply. It is not an unreasonable position. It's not dispositive, but it's not unreasonable in choice of law analysis to say that the law applies in the state where the injury was occurred, where the alleged injury occurred. And so Gavin McInnes is alleging that this injury occurred in New York. Okay, we can do that. The defamation, I'm going to let our listeners download this complaint, linked in the show notes, and judge for themselves. In my view, this is a classic slap strategic lawsuit against public participation. There is nothing that is identified as defamatory that is not already present in those two paragraphs of Wikipedia that I read to you. And even if it was, we all know the standard for a public figure like Gavin McInnes is the New York Times v. Sullivan standard, which requires a demonstration of actual malice, that is, knowing falsity or reckless indifference to the truth. You cannot be recklessly indifferent to the truth if you've gone on and it's on Wikipedia. Absolutely not. And so, you know, these incidents in which they are describing alleged defamation by the SPLC are articles that call the Proud Boys far right and that claim that they endorse violence, right? So the last one is a Rachel Janik article entitled "Violence and Hate, That's the Proud Boys." And the complaint insists over and over again that the Proud Boys do not engage in violence. You know, they talk about the Fight Club bit, which, again, I thought was super clever. At best, all you could possibly demonstrate with this is that there is a difference of opinion. There is absolutely no way that you can meet the New York Times v. Sullivan standard defamation.
Okay, but I'm sure a lot of people who've listened for a while might be thinking, well, but we've had this SPLC thing come up before with Majid Nawaz, and Majid somehow got like millions of dollars from them, and they apologized and took it down. So,
yeah,
what's the difference here?
I think that's right. And you remember we were, and again, it's why I loved our coverage of Majid Nawaz's lawsuit against the SPLC, in which I said the exact same thing, right? In which we were not talking about somebody who is a member of an alt-right hate group. We were talking about somebody who you and I agree with in a great many respects, right? Or a great many, but in many respects, right? And we thought many of his grievances were legitimate, and nevertheless, it does not matter under the New York Times standard. And I was shocked to see the SPLC settle that lawsuit. And I think the fact that they settled this lawsuit was directly the cause for Gavin McInnes deciding to sue them. He's like, look, they're going to run away with their tail between their legs. They're not itching for a fight here. And, you know, and I'm going to get a big stick in Ron Coleman, and we're going to make them apologize to us as well. So hope the SPLC stands strong. If you're listening, drop me an email. Boy, would I love to see Ron Coleman on the other side of the table.
If they stand strong on this, I'm unsure what the point of them would be.
I think that's right. So, for example, and again, this is in the body of the complaint itself. So this is the evidence of statements that Gavin McInnes has claimed in a court pleading are defamatory. So let's talk about, and I'm just picking this at random, August 7th, 2017, Bill Moreland, Unite the Right / Historic Showcase article. So this is an article on the SPLC website dated August 7th, 2017. This is starting at paragraph 241. The August 7th, 2017 article by Bill Moreland is false and defamatory towards Mr. McInnes because it falsely ascribes to him characteristics of SPLC's false description of the Proud Boys, which is not, quote, always looking for a rumble, end of quote. And literally what the article says is, and this is quoted in paragraph 240. I mean, this does not require serious investigative sleuthing here. The article says, quote, the Trump-inspired Proud Boys, called the alt-light by some, and always seeming to be looking for a rumble, may or may not show up in sizable numbers, although the group's founder, Gavin McInnes, says he full-heartedly supports the rally. And then, as you might guess, paragraph 242 says, The article is false and defamatory towards Mr. McInnes because Mr. McInnes did not, quote, full-heartedly support the rally, end of quote, but instead stated that he supported anyone's right to attend the rally. Literally, this is in print. I mean, that this is, and again, I just picked this at random from the defamation section. The defamation claim, in my view, is low-grade nonsense. False light privacy is an interesting tort to add here because one of the things, and this is count three, and again, I'm only going to mention it very, very briefly because what I really want to talk about is count one. I want to get there. But count three is false light invasion of privacy. And one of the things that all of our listeners and even non-listeners tend to know about defamation is, right, truth is an absolute defense to defamation, right? If I call you alt-right and you are in fact alt-right, then guess what? No matter how much you don't like it, if it's the truth, then you can't sue me. False light invasion of privacy, on the other hand, does not have as its element that the statement must be false, right? In fact, you know, the implication is that you can say true things about somebody that nevertheless invade their privacy. And the way in which false light typically works is by saying something that isn't provably false, but is misleading in its characterization and in the implication that is drawn therefrom, right? So in other words, suppose I'm walking through, suppose a spontaneous alt-right rally gathers outside down the street from my office, and I'm walking back from lunch, and I walk through the rally to go get to my car, and a flash goes off and I turn to face it. And then all of a sudden, tomorrow on the front page of the New York Times is, you know, look at this alt-right rally attended by prominent lawyer P. Andrew Torres, right?
Ugh, someone's full of himself.
Front yeah, I was going to say, so, right, I appreciate right. the compliment of being called prominent, right? But like I would say, okay, you know what? Like I was not attending the rally. Like I get that you photographed me and I was there. It wouldn't be defamation, right? That would be false light invasion of privacy. I'd be like, dude, I was just walking back to my car. I turned and looked, and I get that the photo looks bad. And I got a goofy grin on my face or whatever. But now, like,
and your flies down. Oh, no.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Let's put all of that in there.
Let's just embarrass Andrew Moore. You got a stain on your shirt.
Yeah, no, that is that is exactly what this is meant to protect against, right? So it's a thing that may not be technically false, but is so misleading as to cause me demonstrable harm.
That makes sense. Yeah. That makes sense as a thing that you should be able to say, hey, that's not fair.
Yep. Again, I will leave you the count three is meant to be an argument in the alternative or a backstop to the defamation. It is my opinion, having read through the complaint and having read through the Wikipedia article on the Proud Boys, that the argument that is being advanced here is no, like we're being included with all these hate groups and saying we support alt-right rallies, but really we're just, you know, saying we support your right to go to the alt-right rally, and we're being called alt-right and white nationalist, and we're not really white nationalists. We just want pro-Western culture. To me, that does not seem to fit into the fact pattern that I described where, you know, liberal Andrew Torres gets accidentally photographed through a series of weird coincidences. But I will leave that for our listeners to judge, because again, this is highly fact specific. To me, when I read the claims with which Mr. Coleman is picking nits, they do not seem to me to come anywhere close to proving false statement or even a misleading statement. The strangest count is count one, which is tortious interference with economic advantage. And let me describe first in layman's terms what he's trying to do here and why that's dangerous, and then explain why the argument is nonsense. What he's trying to do here is to claim that deplatforming a hate speaker, deplatforming someone from the alt-right, constitutes a business tort for which you can sue a person. I don't think I need to say that is not only profoundly at odds with the spirit of the First Amendment, with the notion that you are a defender of free speech, with the very idea of the marketplace of ideas itself, right? The corollary of the marketplace of ideas is everybody gets to come out and put their arguments out there in the marketplace of ideas, and the ones that have the greatest truth value are likely to win out. And what does win out mean? Win out doesn't mean that, like, there's natural selection and that the people saying dumb stuff get, you know, murdered or that their genes die out. It means that they get deplatformed. It means that people stop listening to them because they're saying stupid things. And if deplatforming becomes an independent tort, then we have lost our justification for permitting extreme and hateful speech in this country, right? And you and I have gone back and forth on this a little bit, right? I tend to be more of a First Amendment absolutist than you. I tend to have more faith in the notion of the marketplace of ideas, and be more willing to say that, you know, we want to protect the exchange of even repugnant ideas. But the way in which we respond to repugnant ideas is by engagement, shame, and deplatforming. That is absolutely at the core of what.
Yeah, I mean, this is a two-step process for these racists. The step one is to pretend, and they've convinced a lot of people of it, pretend it's all about marketplace of ideas. And then after that successful step one, step two is, okay, now that we've done that, now let's outlaw the sue people who actually do the marketplace thing and respond negatively to our ideas and try to do what we actually said was the whole marketplace thing. We'll try to sue them into being too scared to do that. And then there you go.
So now let me explain what tortious interference with economic advantage is, what it really is. Okay. Suppose that I know you, let's go back to your bar exam question. You run you sell bottled water, and I know you have a contract with Acme Industries to purchase their empty water bottles from them, right? And you, pursuant to that contract, buy their water bottles and then fill them up at your, you know, rich mountain stream and then sell them for $2.79 a piece. I come to you and I go, hey, Thomas, you should dump Acme and you should buy from Opening Arguments brand water bottles. Right? Under certain conditions, right? You can then, not you, Acme, if you, Thomas Smith, manufacturer of the pure mountain spring water, break that contract, then Acme water bottles finds out that I came in and convinced you to break your contract with them, then Acme water bottles can sue me, right? They could sue you, but suppose, you know, you're out of money and for whatever reason, they don't want to sue you, right? They want your business again or whatever. They can come and sue me for tortious interference. Okay. Hmm.
I remember this. We've talked about it a little bit, but it does seem kind of weird, especially given the, you know, like the sacred nature of business in this country. Let's say you and I are just friends or something. I mean, we're not, but like, let's pretend we are. No, I'm just kidding. Let's say we're friends, and I see that in your business you have a contract with, you know, what some vendor that I think is like terrible, and I don't have my own business or anything. I'm just like, ooh, is that where you buy your widgets from? They make awful widgets. You know, like, am I not allowed to say that? Otherwise, I might be. If you then terminate your contract, is it only if I am like, okay, now buy my widgets, or just me as a friend saying those widgets are terrible? Is that open me up to being sued?
That is exactly the right question to ask, and I want to flag for you that the core of your question is 100% correct, right? Like, we live in a capitalist system, and by and large, we want people to encourage the free flow of information, even if that information causes somebody to stop doing business with somebody else, right? So,
well, yeah, and if you break a contract with your widget guy, you will probably owe them some money. You know, right. Like, that should be on you. I don't get why that's on me.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Yeah, so, you know, suppose you read a newspaper article that says Acme Water Bottle Company, you know, uses seal eyelashes in the creation of its water bottle. And you're like, well, I don't want to be a part of anybody that's, you know, plucking the eyelashes out of cute little baby seals, right? Like, no, I'm canceling my contract, right? So then in that situation, you would not want the law to be such that Acme water bottle companies, particularly if it were true, could go to the New York Times after having run the expose and sue the New York Times for tortious interference with economic advantage. Right. And again, this is not hard to extrapolate out to everyday conduct, right? Like, I'm pretty sure that once the New York Times started reporting on Michael Cohen, that his law firm practice took a downturn, you know, right? Everything that you report about somebody could potentially fall under this category. And that's why the law has, and this is in the state of New York. That's why I said it was important that the allegation is that the injury took place in New York. But again, it's pretty similar. It's similar in Maryland. It's similar just about everywhere. In the state of New York, for a plaintiff to prove a claim of tortious interference, that plaintiff will have to prove four things. They will have to prove, number one, that he had a business relationship with a third party. Number two, that the defendant knew of that relationship and intentionally interfered with it. Okay. So just publishing an article, right, that happens to interfere with it, not enough. Number three, and this is really the key, that the defendant acted solely out of malice or used dishonest, unfair, or improper means. And then number four, that the interference caused the injury to the relationship. In other words, you have to actually break the contract. So solely out of malice is an unbelievably high standard. And dishonest, unfair, or improper means a crime or a separate tort or physical violence, fraud, civil lawsuits, criminal prosecutions. Okay. That's what it means to tortiously interfere with someone's business relationship. So you are 100% correct that you go tell your friend, oh, hey, you're buying your hamburgers from Wendy's. Like, no, you should go to McDonald's. McDonald's is so right. much better. Right. And they stop buying from Wendy's, start buying from McDonald's. Totally fine. Now, if you go to your friend and you maliciously, because Dave Thomas did something bad to you when you were a child. You know, like
been dead for like 20 years.
Yeah, probably. But like you have a vendetta against the Wendy's Corporation and you then maliciously and using improper means, right? Say something you know is false to your friend to convince them to stop buying Wendy's and start buying McDonald's, then maybe you would have a cause of action. But even then, right, you'd have a really, really good defense to that lawsuit where you're like, yeah, no, you know what? I did hate Wendy's. I did hate Dave Thomas. I did lie to him about it, but I wasn't motivated solely by malice. I was also motivated by the fact that I love McDonald's. And I'm 100% serious that the court would consider that, right?
This sounds like, so now it sounds like a really difficult standard. Does this yes. ever get, are people ever successful with this? It seems incredibly difficult to prove.
Sure. And it both parts of that are correct. It is incredibly difficult to prove. And how you prove it, the way I have litigated these cases before, the way in which you prove tortious interference with economic advantage in virtually every case that I've ever seen is you show, hey, and again, let's use the same parties, right? Thomas Smith Water Bottling Company. What do we call the supplier? Acme Water Bottles and Opening Arguments Water Bottles, right? And the way in which you typically will prove these kinds of cases is Opening Arguments Water Bottles hires away the sales manager of Acme Water Bottling Company. So you've been buying from John at Acme for 20 years. John comes over, starts working for OA, and starts feeding you misinformation or otherwise violating other torts in order to get you to break your contract with Acme and sign a new contract with OA. And so remember the other torts, right? So an example of that might be, suppose John had a valid non-compete agreement. Now, in California, non-compete agreements are presumptively invalid. But you know, suppose this is all in New York, right? So John violates his non-compete agreement when I hire him away, and he's secretly communicating with you and telling you bad stuff about Acme. You break your contract with Acme, and you sign a new contract with Opening Arguments Water Bottles. That's how you would prove this kind of case. The idea that you could bring this for deplatforming is a radical expansion of the doctrine that we would not tolerate in any other business context and should not tolerate in this social context either. So in my view, right, I see people calling this the Gavin McInnes defamation lawsuit. I think it is the tortious interference deplatforming claim that is far more radical, far more dangerous, and is part of why I hope the SPLC fights this as hard as they can.
Wow. Yeah, I agree. I really hope they don't back down like they did with Majid. Otherwise, as I was saying, I just don't know what the point of them would be if they can't, you know, stick to their guns in this instance. All right. Well, I guess we'll see. So prediction time for Andrew, that you don't think they will back down, right?
I'm gonna cloud my prediction with my hope that they do not back down, and yeah. I'm gonna be wrong, I'm gonna roll snake eyes here and come up to ice. This is
all right. Yeah.
And again, no opinion on the New York business law claim. If the law really is that, you know, who knows? Maybe they have some sort of claim under the New York business law. I don't know enough about that law to opine. That's not where the energy in this is anyway. But the defamation, false light, I will let our viewers and listeners judge for themselves. The tortious interference is just not remotely on the facts. And there you go. And I have extended an invitation,
lawyer, right? Huh? This is a real lawyer though. It sounds like
this is a real lawyer, but, and again, I want to be very, very careful here because I've invited Mr. Coleman to come on the show. He's blocked me on Twitter, so I think maybe he won't, but I've invited him to come on the show. If you still have access, he is at Ron Coleman, Coleman on Twitter. Go peruse his Twitter feed and you will see, right? Gavin McInnes is a friend of his.
Boy?
And yeah. His politics are exactly what you would expect. He has, you know, sort of, I'm going to let the facts
he's a
speak
clown
for
horn.
Themselves.
I get
yeah,
it.
He's
okay.
a clown
he's
horn.
A clown
he
horn.
Is absolutely yeah. clown horn. And I think the facts speak for themselves on his Twitter feed. And so I think that his political judgment has clouded his legal
right.
judgment here. So
I see. Yeah.
So there we go.
Okay. Well, all right. It's that time of the show where we've got to thank our new patrons over on patreon.com/law. And why don't you start us off, Andrew?
All right. Thank you to Jack Williams, to Alexis Loesch, to Tom Gallagher, to Christopher Grebe, and to Riley McMillan.
And thank you, Robert Butler. Ben Maculso had to stop because he was broke from bar prep, but is back to... Well, thank you. I think Woo. We get the gist of it. Appreciate it.
Welcome back. You can do that. If you're a former patron and you want to come yeah. back, we'll welcome you back with open arms.
With open shout outs and arms. Dale M., Paul, and Diane Trapp, thank you so much for hopping on board. Hope you enjoy the bonus stuff. And yeah, we encourage everyone else to do so. We're, you know, a couple weeks away from another Lot Awful Movies and Q&A and all that good stuff. Not to mention having a say in the brand new intro you've heard the last couple episodes. That's also a patron perk, so hop on board. All right, now it's time. I have no idea with this TTTBE question. Very curious to find out what the answer was here, so here we go. It's answer time.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
Yeah, we had a timely abortion constitutional law question, which involved a state statute that a minor identify and notify one of her parents at least 48 hours before having an abortion. And then a lawsuit was filed challenging the constitutionality of the statute. Thomas took the bold attempt to say that the statute would be constitutional. He eliminated both of the no answers. No, because a 48-hour waiting period is excessively long and therefore imposes an undue burden. That was a good elimination. But he also eliminated B, which was no, because the state law does not provide a bypass procedure that would allow a court to authorize a minor to obtain an abortion without prior parental notification under appropriate circumstances. And I'm sad to tell you that is the correct answer.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, that was the first one you wrote off the list. You were correct.
I was tempted at first, but it just, yeah, I don't know. I couldn't. It's tough.
This sometimes happens, and it happens with significant frequency in constitutional law cases. So you might remember when we had Andrew Seidel on and it was one of the Ten Commandments cases. And Andrew was like, well, I was on this case. So, you know, so I know that the facts exactly match this. The bar prep book does not say it, but I happen to remember it and looked it up. These are the exact same facts as a 1990 case, Hodgson versus Minnesota. So Minnesota law.
Oh, so we're under the assumption when you take the bar, you're living in a world where precedent matters.
Where precedent does matter.
Yeah.
Right?
So you're living in a fairy tale land where.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But in that case, there was a Minnesota law that required, and again, not exact fact pattern. That the Hodgson case, Minnesota law said that a minor under the age of 18 had to notify both parents 48 hours before obtaining an abortion. So 48 hour waiting period, had to notify both parents. And the Supreme Court said, this is constitutional. This is okay. This is a permissible restriction on the right to an abortion because it provided for the judicial bypass. And even though Hodgson v. Minnesota is 1990, the Casey case was in 1992, which clarified that the standard or set the standard at undue burden. Hodgson is still considered good law. And so in states that have waiting periods or parental notification, which are any state that wants to restrict abortion, right, those are typically some of the first laws that get passed. It is a requirement, and Hodgson has been consistently interpreted for nearly 30 years as the requirement that if you're going to impose a waiting period, 48 hours is okay. Again, you know, you're just harassing these women, but whatever. 48 hours is not considered too long. Requiring minors to notify their parents is not considered overly burdensome so long as you provide for a judicial bypass in the kinds of cases where, you know, you were initially attracted to when you were reading the answers. You were like, well, what if she doesn't have two parents?
Yeah,
what if, you know, it's the father who's raping her, you know, right? So
I just assumed that would be like priced into the deal, I guess. I wasn't sure. Now I'll know going forward, but it just seemed like this would be the kind of thing that you could just do through our current court system, but I guess that's not right. You have to specifically put a clause in there. Okay, well that's a really tough question. I feel like I was mostly there. I feel like I had the rest of it right, but oh well, I fell short. I didn't know that that man. And it's the case before Casey, and it's still good law. That's a tough one. All right. The bar's hard sometimes.
Well, you know, get back in the saddle and we'll get the next one.
Get back to not studying. All right. so I'm very curious for future Andrew. Hop in the time machine. Let us know who got this one right. I feel like if you got this one right, you're probably doing pretty well on the bar exam. So tell us who this week's lucky winner was.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Well, Thomas, lots of good answers this week on Twitter and on Facebook, but I think I'm going to go with Terry Cannon, that is at TerryMCannon, who says, answer is B, as in, boy, is it painful to hear Thomas get it wrong when Andrew basically gave away the answer, saying that it may no longer be good law and thereby hinting that it's unconstitutional. Don't be so cynical, Thomas. A parentless teenager can go to a judge. Well, lots of great choices this week, but I like that one from Terry Cannon, and everyone should give Terry a follow over on Twitter. That is at Terry M. Cannon, and that's Cannon like the weapon. Congratulations on being this week's winner. Enjoy your never-ending fame and fortune.
All right, thanks so much for listening, everybody. Thanks, as always, for the questions, the feedback, the support on patreon.com/law. And we'll see you on Friday for maybe some yodeling. I don't know. Hopefully we're kind of owed
bet
some
so.
Yodeling. Yeah. All right. We'll see you then.
You betray the law.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our production assistant, Ashley Smith, and our researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez and the entire OA Wiki team. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Alicia Cook, Natalie Newell, Emily Waters, Eric Brewer, and Brian. Check out the Opening Arguments Facebook community. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the show's theme song, which is used with permission.